A year ago, just a year ago, I was in Honduras building a school in the tiny village of Los Laureles. Before we started work, the mayor of this tiny little town gave us a tour, showing us the relatively brand new water supply system and telling us about the power grid that had finally reached their remote mountainside village. A few people already had televisions, and that meant that the fertility rate would decrease. Everything here is pretty basic. The road is gravel only because it isn't mud. Thankfully, it has dried out a bit from yesterday's rain. We still have to use the four-wheel drive in places. Streams flow right across the road. There are no bridges. Instead, the stream bed is paved where it crosses the road. This works as long as the water isn't too deep. On the way, he showed us coffee growing in the field. Looked like a mountainside to me. Here I was in coffee country and I hadn't even realized it. So I learned to distinguish the coffee trees, bushes from the banana trees growing side by each on the mountain. It is planting time. There are dark green coffee seedlings about a foot high sitting in the shade, waiting for their turn to be planted. It is also picking time. The promised volunteers are few. A coffee tree is really a big bush, 7 to 9 feet high, and lots of little branches, not any big ones. It wouldn't do much good for them to be taller, as the coffee berries are picked by hand. Imagine two coffee beans faced to each other with a husk around it. That's the berry. They have to be picked at just the right time, and so the pickers come back time after time to get them at just the optimum ripeness, the right shade of red, I guess. As we bump along in the back of the pickup truck, we see patios covered with the picked berries, drying in the breeze and the sun. And sometimes they're not on concrete, sometimes they're just on a plastic sheet on the ground. In one place, we can see the small machine used to break the hulls away from the beans. And we also smell the discarded hulls now fermenting. It wasn't what we call pleasant. A man leads a donkey carrying several bags of coffee, just like in those old ads. A coffee crop comes off in many stages, not all at once, like wheat or barley. Blooms and ripe and even overripe berries can be seen all at the same time. Depends on what the micro ecosystem is like, too. After petroleum, coffee is the most traded product, agricultural product, in the world. On this day, after the Jewish New Year of the Trees, Tu Bishvat, it seems like a good time to look again at trees, to consider our relationship with them. Buber reminds us that trees can be object, the origin of our morning coffee, the landscaping in our yard, the industry that has shaped British Columbia, or the spectacular wood of our dining room table. It is easy to see trees as inanimate objects, the plants we utilize for many things, there for our exploitation, our use. If we do so wisely, trees provide many useful things for us, not least of which is food. Trees require us to think long term, for they do not produce immediately. They may give us their fruit or nuts over a long period, though. There is a Jewish story. One day when Honi, the righteous man, was out walking, he came upon a man planting a carob tree. "How long will it be," he asked, "before this tree bears fruit?" 70 years, the man replies. "How do you know you'll be alive 70 years from now?" "Just as I found carob trees when I came into the world," answered the man, "so I am now planting carob trees for my grandchildren to enjoy." Thinking like a tree would be good for the world and good for our children. We eat the fruits and nuts. Other trees, just by their presence, conserve soil and water and breathe in the carbon dioxide that we produce so vociferously, returning to us the oxygen that we need. Who would have guessed that Vancouver, home of so many trees, would actually have a bylaw requiring permits to cut one down? Not only is one limited normally to cutting one tree a year, but you have to replace it too. The value of trees is acknowledged and protected here. Buber also reminds us of the potential for more, the potential for a relationship to trees. He says, "It can also happen, if will and grace are joined, that as I contemplate the tree, I am drawn into a relation, and the tree ceases to be an it." Can we relate to a tree, as if it were subject, like we are subjects? In an anthology of religion, nature, and environment called This Sacred Earth, two theologians and a forester together posit that trees are responsive organisms. They respond to other organisms around them. They cooperate in many ways. Some trees associate with a fungus to help each other grow better, it appears. And they give other examples. They propose a new forestry, a listening forestry that is open to the feedback from individual trees. A whole new worldview to consider. We think sometimes of our cultural world open to a new worldview, a new group that we hadn't included before. What about the plants? How many of us have listened to trees, like the naturalist and wilderness advocate John Muir did? As a child, I had a favorite tree, a blown-down apple tree, in which I sat and read for hours on end. It was a place of refuge and safety. Did I listen to it? Did I pay attention to its needs? I don't remember doing anything like that. I was only 10. Muir said that listening to a plant cultivates empathy, that intuitive projection by which we imagine the character and feelings of another. It is a way to create the kind of understanding we hope for in human relationships, recognition of another's living integrity. Of trees, Muir said, "I could distinctly hear the varying tones of individual trees, spruce and fir and pine and leafless even oak. Each was expressing itself in its own way, singing its own song and making its own particular gestures." Assuming that trees are responsive creatures challenges traditional forestry practices, they acknowledge. I think that's an understatement. But they are not the only ones to relate to plants this way. Nobel Prize winner Barbara McClintock views the corn plants that she works with as, quote, unique individuals and as mysterious other. They hope that the new forestry will be characterized by a relationship of listening and communion. Rather than pure preservationism or objective management, it will be a stewardship of care. Forestry practices would be a stewardship of care that attends to trees in all their rich and nuanced diversity, variability, and individuality. Instead of reducing trees to economic objects that can be explained from a distance through quantifying measurements, the new forestry will be rooted in kindred subjectivity. In other words, it will attempt to understand trees as eloquent others who have wisdom to share. Douglas Todd, religion editor of the Vancouver Sun, wrote a couple of weeks ago about the big new movie just out. Avatar is, in effect, a visually overwhelming 3D action-adventure sermon. Yeah, he used that word, sermon. The two key theological concepts that pastor, or as we would usually say, director Cameron teaches from his global pulpit in Avatar is, God is feminine, and nature is infused with her divine spirit. End quote. The indigenous folks of the distant planet Pandora identify with their tree of souls. Cutting it down for the mine that the outsiders want to open is unthinkable to them, for therein dwells their mother goddess. Todd makes the case that the theology presented in Avatar is panentheism. The spirit of the divine, he says, in Avatar is described as both emanating from the transcendent monotheistic god, Awa, but also as being embodied in everything that is, ranging from the tree of souls to all living entities. The respected Westminster Dictionary of Christian Theology defines pantheism this way: the doctrine that all is in God. It is distinguished from pantheism, which identifies God with the totality or all of everything. For panentheism holds that God's inclusion of the world does not exhaust the reality of God. God is in the world and out of the world. Panentheism is a kind of theism where God is part of everything. Very definitely not the iconic image of the old man in the sky or king of the world. Panentheism is, in fact, my interpretation of our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence, of which we all are a part. It feels so congruent for me. So it's no big stretch to think that we could have relationships with trees for me. A first step is obviously respect and consideration and gratitude for what they provide us. Pascal said that we each have a God-shaped vacuum inside us, attracting us to divinity. No wonder we are attracted to that which we find divine, the trees. Blessed be.